Oh, welcome to Murder Thursday, Jan, and we are glad to see that we have a person here that's been cranking out a mystery every year since 1993. Jeez.
Yeah. Kind of marked down a little lately, but yes.
Well, not really. You just kind of branched out a little bit. But we have like 9, I think, or 10 Irene Kelly mysteries, including the Edgar-winning Bones, which if they ever asked me to put a list of the top 10 mysteries in the world on, oh, and good, there's one of your German Shepherds.
Yeah, that's they're both actually mutts from the pound, but I'm going to close the front door so that they have fewer things to excite them. We won't get that interruption again.
Oh, yeah, well, you might get it on my side, too, because I have a Portuguese water dog every so often. They get confused and think she's a lap dog. So.
Yeah, well, no one is allowed to walk down the sidewalk in the front of our house.
Well, I should think not. Who else is going to guard that sidewalk?
Right.
Okay, let's see. She's done Edgar Whiting Bones, which should be on the list of anybody's best 10 novels, mystery novels, plus a spinoff, a standalone, a book of short stories. She's edited a couple of things for other people. By the way, did I mention the Agatha, the two McCavities, or the Ellery Queen Readers Award for her short stories? Not to mention founding the Crime Lab Project and the Crime Lab Foundation and serving on numerous mystery-related organizations. And bringing peace to the Mideast, right?
not there yet.
Oh, okay. That's one still in the works. All right.
Right, yeah.
So I'm going to talk a little bit about you first, and then I'm going to talk about your books. You live in Southern California with your two German-like shepherds and Dr. Frankenstrat.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, no, the dogs are mutts from the pound. The husband has better breeding.
That's good to hear.
Yeah.
And now you moved to Southern California when you were 6 and a half.
Right.
So I was curious, is there any Texas influence in you, or are you just a California girl all the way?
Well, I pronounce the words P-E-N and P-I-N the same. There are leftovers of Texas. And if you put me around anyone from the Lone Star State,
It just
takes about a minute and a half for me to start to draw and y'all and all that. But, no, I get back to Texas. My brother lives there. I have a lot of cousins there and extended family. We have one of those big Irish clans. And we get together about every 3 years, quite often in Texas, because that's where most of the family still lives. But, I still have attachments to Texas and get back there once in a while, but I haven't lived there since I was in grade school. So I did eventually, I think I was about 12 before I realized that people had stopped calling me Tex.
And then you could pass for California.
Huh? Right, yeah.
Well, you're a pretty well-read California girl. Greek playwrights, Roman poets, Shakespeare, Dickens, Twain. That's quite a classical collection of books.
Well, there's much more that I haven't read, and I read a great deal of material that other people would probably label pure trash. So it isn't all highbrow.
Hey, I got to tell you, some of it's not pure trash. You endured me to my heart when you put on your list of favorite books, Modesty Blaze. I love Modesty Blaze.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. You know, Modesty needs a bigger audience, I think. Peter O'Donnell has become a friend of mine.
Oh, how cool.
That's really one of the things I would say is one of the best things that has happened to me since I started writing.
Oh, that's great.
A fan of each of our works basically introduced us to each other.
Uh-huh.
And
do you think there's a way that Modesty influenced your heroine?
You know, it's possible. I don't know if in some way, I mean, Irene doesn't have, some people may not know who Modesty Blaze is, so I guess I should say that she began as a character in a comic strip in England in the Evening Standard and was the longest running adventure strip, actually written by one author, I think still holds that record. It's 40-some years. And
she
basically, she's got a very complex history, but in a nutshell, she was a criminal who made a lot of money and retired in England and decided to do her best to go after, as she says, the ungodly. someone in English government realized that she had unique skills and access to circles that the law enforcement might not usually be able to get to. And the great thing about Modesty is just that she has a set of skills. She's a very capable and able woman. Now, right now, people probably don't think so much of that, but in 1960, she was incredibly unusual.
I know.
So I really see him as someone who broke a lot of ground.
Yes, absolutely. Carved out the idea that a woman could be strong and powerful and have very strong values and kick butt.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So was reading an inherited addiction in your bloodline?
I think, I was surrounded by people who read a lot. We always had books in our house when we were kids. If we were at the grocery store and saw some little toy we wanted, my mom might say no, but if we asked for a book, we almost always got it. I think that we were encouraged. Going to the library was a family event. It was something we looked forward to. It was a very fun thing to do together. So, at the time, that just all seemed like, wasn't everybody doing this, to us?
Right.
But when I became an adult, I realized I was very lucky.
Right. Yeah. I know. And I get, one of the things I read about is the image of you struggling your way through Scientific American and then your dad sort of trying to fill in the blanks there.
There were an awful lot of blanks at first. The photography in the magazine has always been marvelous. The graphics have been great.
Sure.
So sometimes it was just explain this picture to me.
What is this spiral helix, Dad?
Yeah. Well, and in fact, that was one great thing about him is he loved answering questions or, teaching us things. So that was always a lot of fun.
Your mom also sounds like quite a lady. Mother of four kids, president of the PTA, founder of the school library, painter, activist, and dealing with cancer.
Yeah, she died when I was 12. I think certainly that was long enough to make an incredible impact.
What do you think her legacy to you is?
Oh, well, I think certainly my activism comes out of growing up with someone who, if people said to her, my best example of this is the school library at our elementary school. She thought we should have a library at the school. The nearest library was, I guess, about a mile or so away from this elementary school. But for young children, that was more than she thought. They should have to walk to get a book. And it should be books right there at the school. So she was told that there was no budget, no staff, no room for this. It was basically an all-around no. Sorry about that. Good idea, but we can't do it.
Right.
And within a year, we had a school library. there were teachers who agreed with her, who gave up one of their break rooms, some space in their break room. She got volunteers in the community, other parents to donate books and money for books, and she got volunteer parents to staff it. So, that was my introduction into
your model.
What to do when someone says no to you.
Sounds like the crime lab project was no problem when it came along. You were ready for it.
Yeah, no, we were. And, she had me, going out in political campaigns. She had me, hanging door hangers when I was seven. So,
oh, great.
Early on, the notion was sort of drilled into us that you owe something to your community. You don't go through life just taking.
Mm-hmm.
You pay have it to forward. Be a, it's a two-way participation thing.
Yeah. Great. Sounds like a great lady.
Yeah.
I love the story. I love that you said that you'd never read Nancy Drew or anything like that. I know. It's like people ask me stuff like that. I read The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich as a kid, you know. I never read, like, The Hardy Boys.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I understand now that I've seen some of those why they intrigue kids and, you know, anything that makes a kid read,
right.
I'm all for
right,
it.
But right.
They just weren't my thing nope. when I was in school.
Now, you grew up in Orange County, and I guess, like, most people's images of Orange County is that it's fairly conservative.
Sorry about that.
Somebody must be walking past.
Yeah, yeah.
Sorry. No, hey, no problem.
You know, you've been quiet all day, but...
Oh, hey, if we're lucky enough to get somebody to knock on the door, I will have a whole chorus.
Right, right, right.
But it sounds like the high school you went to doesn't really kind of fit into that stereotype. So tell us about the Griffins.
Oh, wow, my goodness. Let's see. First of all, it absolutely was conservative. I mean, the John Birch Society was in full swing, you know. We moved from Garden Grove to Los Alamitos, and Los Alamitos had a brand new high school, and it was built, you know, and planned in the late 60s, and they put something called flexible scheduling into this plan, and the idea was that instead of attending English at 10 o'clock every morning for an hour and history at, you know, 11 o'clock and on and on and on, your history class would be offered for, it would be offered several times a day, and you would fit it into your schedule for that day when you wanted to take it. And you could also choose, to some extent by doing that, which instructor you would have for that course. And if the day's work was reviewing reading material, then you might only have history for half an hour. If it was a full-blown lecture or a test, it might be an hour. If it was just to see a film, again, it might just be half an hour.
Oh, God, that sounds like fascinating.
Yeah, it was much more like college, really.
Right.
Ways. And you could also take different, it wasn't all in this sort of standard mode. For example, if you were taking English, you could take black literature, a short story class, a Greek mythology class.
Oh, man.
You know, so all these things. And it was a really wonderful thing for the very, for the motivated, bright student. For the student that wasn't doing so well, it was a train wreck.
And where did you fall in on that?
Because at that time, you know, they didn't show up first. They didn't, you know, follow their schedules you know, they needed more structure, I guess. For me, it was, you know, it didn't do great things for my grades because I certainly farted around to, you know, a kind of teenager's extent. And I think, you know, when I look back on it, I was probably... Well, no, probably about it. I was undoubtedly still dealing with the changes in our family. My mother had died. My dad had remarried. We had moved from our old neighborhood. A lot of change. And so I didn't do spectacular. I wasn't, you know, anyone national merit scholar. We'll put it that way. But I, you know, at the same time, I also learned a whole lot about, we'll just call it the system, you know, about what a person could get away with and not get away with.
Valuable education.
Right, you know, and actually, I have to say, learning to work the rules remained helpful.
It's the most important lesson one could learn in high school. Exactly. So I was talking to Michael Connelly on this show, and he said that he knew in college that he wanted to write mysteries and just went towards that like an arrow. Now, your career's been a bit more circuitous. Camp counselor, waitress, clerk, centerless grinder, singer, oral historian, plant manager.
Doc, you do your homework.
How did you get from there to best-selling mystery writer?
Well, when I was 7, I knew I wanted to write. I had a teacher who put a poem up on the bulletin board, and they had me from there. And, in fact, when I was 13 or so, I tried to write my first novel. We were assigned a short story, and being an overachiever, I said I would write a novel. My instructor very kindly did not step on that dream. He said, go right ahead.
Right.
It was going to be a novel about Micronesia, and I didn't know anything about Micronesia. I had just seen it on our new family globe. It
looked like a great place to set a novel.
You know, you could hide all kinds of things on all these little islands, but alas, there were only about two paragraphs in it in my encyclopedia, and I was dumped from there. Hadn't learned to research yet. So that was my first failed novel was about Micronesia. But no, seriously, I wanted to write, but the message that was delivered to me repeatedly was that no one ever got a job writing. That was fine for a hobby or a little side pursuit, but really it wasn't a thing one could get hired doing.
Yeah.
And despite being told that, I still had all kinds of creative pursuits. I did a lot of stuff with music, especially in high school and college, a little bit of stuff with film. But it wasn't until much later, I guess there are two things that happened here. One is that I went to work for my father's company, and the next thing I knew, he was retiring, had sold the company to a big corporation, and I was managing the plant for them, and I was miserable.
Yeah.
Not with the people I was working with or even the work itself, but
just
corporate politics. Just corporate politics drove me nuts.
Yeah.
And the other thing was that just before all this happened, I had interviewed Rosie the Riveter. And these were women who worked in aircraft plants. And I realized that the people who were happy later in life were the ones who had pursued their dreams. The people who were unhappy were the ones who said things like, I always wanted to, I wish I had.
So those gals kind of inspired you to wake up, huh?
They did. I thought about them a lot. I thought, I don't want to be 80. And
right.
Thinking to myself, I want to write a book someday.
Mm-hmm.
As for mystery, I think I truly fell in love with it pretty much about the same time Mike did in terms of my age. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was in college. I had read Agatha Christie in high school. I enjoyed those books. But I didn't really get a sense of what one could do with crime fiction until I started reading Chandler and Hammett,
right.
Allingham and Sayers, and
right.
like that. So.
And then you saw it was really honest to God, valuable genre.
I've never in my life been someone who disses entertainment.
Yeah.
I think entertainment's very valuable to
mm-hmm.
us. And I also think, so even the so-called fluff within the genre, I value that. It's important to us. And quite often, books that are not as violent as other books still have something very valuable to talk about. So I don't, you know, I don't believe in that kind of let's build a hierarchy
right.
Kind of thing.
Right, the cozies are less important than the noir.
Right, right. I mean, it's this strange thing of that we seem to need to crown a king somewhere. I don't get that.
I don't get it either.
I prefer the anarchy.
It doesn't work in politics. It doesn't work in literature.
No, and our real taste, if you just look at what sells, you know,
right.
alone, it should say that, you know, people do find something in these
right.
stories that captivates them. And if it's nothing more than escape, well, hey, fine.
Yeah,
you know?
Like escape is a bad thing?
Right, right. Right. Some people really do have quite a bit they need to escape from.
Right.
But the other thing is that, that aside, I don't think this genre is simply entertainment or escape. Mm-hmm. I think it actually has always commented a great deal on society and in some serious ways and in ways, frankly, that, you know, it could easily be argued that it's less self-centered
right.
Than some other
areas
of writing. So, you know, I don't want to put down literary quote-unquote
right.
novels either, but because I do think, you know, thought-provoking,
mm-hmm.
introspective works have their place too. But you know, it is that whole thing of, I guess I compare it to sort of eating. You know, who wants a diet of nothing but crackers and water? I mean, you know, life is a banquet, and literature is as well, and you ought to be able to sample across the table and not feel...
not feel guilty for the chocolate cake and not feel particularly virtuous for the broccoli. Either.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely right.
You once said your favorite movie was Rear Window. I thought about that. I was thinking about Rear Window. Do you think we are all us mystery writers, or maybe all writers, are kind of voyeurs looking into the window of our own landscape?
You know, I don't know. In fact, I'm sitting there thinking, when did I say that and why? But but I do love that film. I
know.
Still love that film. I think the thing about that film that really strikes me is that I saw it before the claws in Hitchcock's will kept it, you know, from being viewed for a while. It had been on television once, and it scared the living daylights out of me. And it did that really without any overt violence in it. I mean, it's all implied,
right?
Exactly, and. So I remember just being sleepless after seeing that thing and how clearly it was in my mind, and then went to see it when it was available again and could be shown again and you know, got the videotape from my local video store and watched it and was just as riveted.
Mm-hmm.
And but, you know, sometimes when you go back,
right, I know.
You go, oh, what, you know, okay, you were a kid.
Right.
You're
the Wizard of Oz. Looked a little tacky the second time around. Yeah, that's a hell of a movie. You're right.
But, so I think what I always admire, in not just in Rear Window, but in Notorious and other films of Hitchcock's, were his ability to build suspense and keep, you know, the watcher totally engaged, anticipating things, not having things go as anticipated.
Right, and jumping out of your seat.
Right, still stepping up the tension. And you know, he really was, I think, a master of the whole psychology of suspense and the audience, what he was doing to his audience every step of the way.
There's something we can all learn there.
Absolutely. And in fact, I do quite often find myself intentionally watching him before sitting down to write a novel, just to remind myself of those lessons. Study his craft.
Yeah, that's an excellent craft. So let's talk about your inner landscape of Las Piernas. Is that how you pronounce it?
Piernas, yeah.
Yeah.
Spanish. Yeah, from eggs.
Where Long Beach meets Laguna. What is it about this town that attracts you to it?
Well, a lot of people have written, and written well, about the mean streets of Los Angeles.
Right.
If you read books about Southern California, they are almost always set in urban landscapes. Despite the fact, Jeff Parker has, of course, done other things with that.
Right.
And now, certainly, you know, Don Winslow and other people have spread things out a bit. But I haven't seen, there may have been out there, but I have not seen books written about the Southern California coastal town.
Right.
They're very different in nature from Northern California coastal cities.
Very different. I live in one of those Northern California coastal
cities. Right. So you know exactly what I mean.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they are still that extension, you know, to some extent of L.A., and yet not. You know, Long Beach is a city of 500,000 folks. If you pulled it away from underneath Los Angeles and dropped it anywhere else, it would be a major city that everybody knew about.
Right.
But it's, I sometimes say it's like Canada. You know, you have this big thing next to you,
right.
You know, the attention, otherwise people would notice what you're up to. So it's got a lot of crime, it's got rich and poor, it's got, and yet this superficial paradise that comes with being from along the coast.
Right.
And I found that, you know, if you looked at Newport Beach, if you looked at Laguna, if you looked at San Clemente, if you went as far north as Venice, which is, you know, L.A. needed a warm water port, so they came down to San Pedro and annexed it
at some
point in history. But if you look at San Pedro and Venice and all those cities, Redondo Beach, Manhattan Beach, everything along the coast, I sort of grab from as far north as Venice and as far south as San Clemente. And if I need a boat topography, I do the same thing. It all lands about where Long Beach is.
Right.
And Long Beach is never referred to in the story because Los Piranhas is sitting on top of it.
But you get the luxury of being able to toss in a hotel or a zoo whenever you want to. That's
absolutely
so nice.
Right.
I mean, I write Berkeley, and it's got to be Berkeley. It's like I went before I sent my first manuscript, and I went in just as a kind of intuitively to check where I dumped a body, and this park had turned into a parking lot.
Yeah.
Oh, it's like you have to worry about that.
Yeah, cities change. Mm. I remember Larry Block telling a story about having someone write to him from Florida saying that, you know, this guy wrote, "I lived in New York for, you know, 60 years, and you can't get from here to here on the subway." And Larry wrote back, "You know, they didn't have the town bronze the day you moved away." And
surprise.
But yeah, real cities change. And the other thing that happens is that, people. I mean, I enjoy that my readers know that, especially if they live in the Long Beach area, they know what I'm writing about, whatever I call it. I might call it, you know, a certain bookstore or whatever. They'll know it's Acres of Books.
I know.
So
I went to Cal State Long Beach for a while, so it's like it felt like old home to me.
So it's kind of a game for them. It could be a kind of cruel game sometimes. I did have someone tell me that they spent quite a bit of time looking for the cliffs one day out in the ocean.
Go up the coast a little ways.
Yeah. But, you know, in Bloodlines, like the tunnels, all those are features of real historical Long Beach.
So let's talk about Irene. She's a newspaper reporter, which is the only thing that isn't on your resume. It does get her into crime scenes, but did you ever want her to be anything besides a newspaper reporter, or did she just come in and tell you that's the way it's going to be, and you're going to have to...
Yeah, no, she created herself a reporter. I'm not exactly sure where that came from. I had an uncle who was a reporter. I admired him a lot. Mm-hmm. I was in college in the Watergate years. I always loved his Gal Friday. I thought at one time of studying journalism because I wanted to write, and it seemed like a career. I think actually a number of people who do this, they become journalism majors and go to work for a newspaper thinking they'll write their book afterwards, and not realizing that by the end of the day, trying to knock out a story, the last thing you want to do is sit down and write. I admire anyone actually who is a reporter who managed to get that
job. I know. There are some
sitting in the dresser.
They're very impressive. Of course, it's not that much easier to be a plant manager and come back home and write either.
Well, you know, I tell people all the time that the body count in Goodnight Irene is just sort of that of the Titanic, because I killed off a lot of people I was working with. It was very therapeutic. And it did teach me, you know, how people get so angry at each other that they want to kill each other. You know, I never did that or really sincerely wanted to do that, but there were times when I just thought, you know,
a slight temperament problem. Right in.
Right. No, I mean, I think, you know, if I had been raised differently or whatever, you know, who knows. But I started to see that, you know, I would see these people whose life had been invested in this kind of temperament, you know, and they were all about protecting that investment.
Right.
And
when change happens, it's really scary for them.
Yeah. Yeah, so I was glad to get out of that world, I have to say. And it was, you know, it's kind of interesting because not long after I became a writer, that plant was closed by the company, and the company itself was sold to, dare I say it, Halliburton.
Hey, just think, you could be in Iraq right now.
They probably would have sent me over there if they couldn't. But no, I you know, that people that had been working in that plant, some of them found jobs in another company in Arkansas. You know, I wouldn't have been living in California if I had gone on with this. I doubt, actually, being in the position I was, I doubt I would have been hired by them.
Right.
And I also think that, well, I just knew an awful lot of people who lost a great deal when that takeover happened. You know,
right.
they didn't all find new jobs in that
company. Those kind of things can be pretty devastating.
Right. So you know, I know the day that I went into my tax accountant and told him that I was, you know, leaving my job and going to write full time, he looked at both of us being self-employed, thought I had lost my mind.
Look at it this way, you'll have a lot more forms to file.
Right. But, you know, as it turned out, it all
turned out to be the right idea.
Yeah.
So Irene is strong and tough and resilient and vulnerable and has a ton of integrity. Sue Grafton said she's afraid that someday she's going to open her door and Kimsey's just going to put a bullet in her head for all the hell that she's been put through. What do you think Irene would say to you if she met you?
Oh, goodness. What would she say to me? I don't know. I don't know what she would say to me. We, you know, it's odd to sort of think of that happening because I look at, actually one of the weirdest experiences I've ever had writing was when I was writing Flight, which is a spinoff of the series that is written
right,
from
Frank.
Frank Harriman's point of view, primarily.
Right.
And I realized that he had driven home and that he was going to open the front door and Irene was going to be on the couch, and that for me it was going to be an out-of-body experience because I see the book's first person through her.
Uh-huh.
So the idea of
being
outside looking at her was just as odd as it could be.
Oh, wow.
Writing about her third person was strange.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad I went through that because I had originally wanted to write the book about O'Connor early on. I almost from the time I wrote Goodnight Irene, I thought I'd better come back and write about this guy. But I kept putting it off for, you know, whatever reasons, and I knew I wanted to write Flight before I got the Blood Violence, and I didn't realize until later how well that had prepared me for third-person scenes viewing her. But they're still always a bit strange for me. So the idea of having her actually be at the front door is kind of spooky to me.
I know. I get it. So, like, Frank is a real interesting character. I mean, I remember at one point in some interview you were talking about how you didn't want him to be a file drawer character. How do you see him evolving over the 10 books?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that's happened with Frank and Irene is that they were pretty independent and hot-tempered each in their own ways. He's wrapped very tightly, so he does have a temper, but and she has to provoke it out of him. He keeps that baby under wraps
right.
the time,
of
you
course,
know.
She's more than willing to do that.
Yeah, no, and she pushes his buttons. So, but that's kind of, you know, part of their pattern. But I do see them having learned to work better in harness, I'll say, than they did at first. I see them as now having fewer of those. You know, they didn't need to stay hot-headed all their lives. they may still be passionate people, each in their own way.
Right.
But I see them now as having figured a few things out about each other. I mean, I think he's figured out by now that he's not going to be able to keep her from being in danger.
Right.
And I think when they were first together, he felt he had to protect her, you know, and as protective, she has come to realize that he's always going to feel compelled to do that. She
right.
can live with that to a certain extent.
Right.
But I think he, by now, has a better sense of what's, you know, I think they each do have a better sense of what's going to give and what's not going to give, you know, what you live with. And I think they've worked out their job conflicts, their places of employment haven't worked them out yet.
Right. Right.
But as individuals, I think, you know, they figured out how they were going to be together, you know, and be ethical and true to professions that meant a lot to them.
So I just thought of this question. I don't quite know how to frame it, but it's kind of like we don't want our characters to get too mentally healthy because they get boring if that happens. And at the same time, you know, I mean, the way some authors do it is they just kill off, you know, a major character just to keep things interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't, and I always feel like that's cheating in a particular kind of way. Like, I'm much more interested to see how people grow up.
Yeah, I remember when I was my first year going to any conventions, I went to a Left Coast Crime, and a writer I admired greatly said that she would never let her character marry because marriage was boring. This was not, by the way, Sue Grafton, because I know when you say a woman writer, people immediately go to the superstars. But, Sue didn't say this. This is another writer. And she said, you know, that marriage is boring. And I remember thinking, well, mine's not. So why would that have to be? And that meant thinking about why mine isn't, you know?
Yeah.
I really and Frank have a very different marriage than Tim and I have, but
far fewer bodies for one thing.
much less of that. But
your people that's what I love about your series, because your people are growing up, you know?
Mm-hmm.
They really are. They're not the same people they used to be, and yet that doesn't mean that you have to get a divorce or kill somebody.
Right. Now, I think it is true, and I think that it really depends on what you're doing with character in the first place. If you have the kind of book in which the characters do not change, and that's a tried-and-true form of writing the mystery novel.
Right, right.
I don't know that it works to have Philip Marlowe in a relationship, you know, because Philip is Philip Marlowe, you know, whenever you meet him.
On the other hand, Robert Parker has his character, Spencer, doesn't change a lot, but is still in a relationship with Susan, so.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, if you look at, sometimes people think that this changing of characters is a brand new thing, but it's not. I mean, for one thing, Dorothy L. Sayers, Peter Wimsey, certainly evolves over that series.
Exactly. Same relationship.
Right. And actually, if you go back and read Red Harvest by Dashiell Hammett, you'll realize that that character is profoundly affected by the violence that he's involved in. Now, the love interest is killed off. still, you know, I think there's change and there's change. But anyway, I do think, you know, for me, it was natural to who they were. It would have been very unnatural. She's one of her chief characteristics is her loyalty. And I just cannot imagine her dumping Frank.
Right. She's
you know.
Pure blue.
Right. And I think in so many ways they complement each other that you know, in all likelihood he's gonna stick around.
Well, I love you putting down a stake for the fact that marriages can be dangerous and exciting and alive for a long period of time.
Yeah, it's very interesting that I get a lot of feedback about that from male readers. My readers tend to be pretty much 50-50 male, female. My findings, the audiences are always mixed. Quite often men come up to me and say, you know, thanks for writing about a guy who's happily married.
Right. It means a lot to us, us happily married people.
Yeah.
So one of the things I love is that you have a subtext for each book that kind of inspires you, but that kind of could very well go unnoticed by the readers. I do the same thing. Like with each book I write, I explore a different psychopathology. They have no idea that I'm doing that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you wouldn't even know it unless you were there, you know, in the writer's head,
mm-hmm.
knowing that that's what's going on. So you do themes like compassion and bones, or recovery from trauma and Hocus, or
mm-hmm.
estrangement and liar.
Mm-hmm.
I was curious, are these themes the seeds of the book, or do they emerge as you write into the book?
I know fairly early on that's the underpinning.
Mm-hmm.
That I have to have that early. I may not have it before. I may not have it immediately, but it'll be very close to immediately. For me, sometimes what happens is I hear something or observe something, and I'm just struck by a contrast. I'm struck by my emotional reaction to it, I'll say. And that, when I feel myself react in that way, I start asking myself questions about where those feelings come from and what it is about this, you know, story I read in the paper or whatever that intrigued me. And the book may never have anything to do with, say, that story in a newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
I may not write about anything that has facts similar to those. But the essence of that, or whatever it was that I decided brought out the reaction in me, will quite often be the anchor for the book. And with Kidnap, you know, I was looking at this whole drive to have perfect,
yeah, the perfect family, huh?
You know, and I decided I didn't like that idea much, and then I started asking myself, well, why?
Uh-huh.
You know? And so that led to everything that followed from there.
Yeah. One of the things, I just loved your turn of phrase. It's just stayed with me while I was studying you. When you talked about liar, you talked about, it was about estrangement and about the personal gospels we tell each other, or we tell ourselves to justify our estrangement. I love that phrase.
Thank you.
Like the personal gospels. Like,
well, I think, you know, it gets to that level.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know,
and we repeat them. We repeat the liturgy word for word.
Right. These are our beliefs, you know?
Uh-huh.
And you can't, you know. And I think it's at some point, you know, if you're going to move on, you have
right.
to be willing to understand that that's not quite what they are.
It may not be the truth.
Yeah.
It's just the story.
It's very hard. I think it's very hard. Once people, especially if they've been hurt or feel betrayed, it's very hard for people to let go of what they've told themselves about.
Yep.
This is how this betrayal came about.
Yep.
I find this in myself, you know. I have a, you know, if someone hurts me, I have a little story I tell myself about how that all came about. And if we've had some kind of estrangement, you know, well, this is why it happened. And oddly, I'm using the right.
Yeah, usually the story is about how craven they are.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
How, you know, how selfish and abusive,
uh-huh.
and how they turned out to be the devil in disguise.
Right.
And I, like the person that I am, took the only course I could take. In.
Which is the angel's path, of course.
Yes, exactly. Well, that's not really.
No, of course not. That's the trouble with God.
Yeah, you don't always realize that unless you grow up.
I know.
And
it's always hard.
Yeah.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about how you write. I say that there's two schools. There's the Jim Fuseli school of writing, in which he has the next six novels outlined. And then there's the S.J. Roseanne school, in which he just...
I don't mean to laugh at him. I mean, that's...
No, I know, it's true. I mean, there's a lot of people like...
that was
Julia Spencer Fleming.
School.
You know? I mean, Julia Spencer Fleming knows how the whole series is going to go out. And
mm-hmm.
then there's S.J. Roseanne, who has no idea. She just sits down and starts writing. That's your school, right?
Yeah, no, I'm not an outliner. My belief is that people who've heard me speak, I'm going to bore anyone who's listening to this who's heard me talk about this before, but I really see it as being akin to being left-handed or right-handed. If you are more naturally an outliner, by all means, that's how you work. If that's what allows you, I know people who outline who feel it gives them the freedom to proceed because they feel they've got the structure to work with from there, and
right.
they just cannot possibly write without one. And they feel as stymied about writing without one as I feel about writing with
right.
one.
Right.
So I don't think there's a more virtuous path here. I think sometimes, to be honest, you know, if we're honest here, the outliners tend to feel more virtuous about being outliners.
That's true.
They believe that, you know, and I think it goes back to sort of, you know, how you were taught to write exposition in school. And certainly, if you're writing an essay, there's a nonfiction work, there's some
right.
sense to having that kind of structure. But,
no, there is an elite, a very subtle elitism in there. You're right.
Yes, yes.
And there's, and on the other hand, the people that just kind of write into the novels,
mm-hmm.
there's a very subtle kind of self-deprecation to it. Like, well, yeah, that's what works for me, you know.
Well, I mean, I do meet people occasionally who don't outline who sort of feel like they have the true creative expression.
Right.
What they come back with, you know, their little smuttiness. But, yeah, I don't believe that for a minute.
Oh,
I mean, I think that it just happens to be, I don't know if it's, someday some geneticist will find the part that double helix.
Where in the DNA comes
out? The outliner gene or the, you know, or the non-outliner gene, whichever it may be. But something.
Because I'm an outliner and you're a non-outliner, but I still agree with you that revision is where we get the stink out of the manuscript.
Mm-hmm.
That's such a great line.
Yeah, it's revision gives me the power to write and to
right.
be unafraid. I don't know many people who can make a complete mess of a year's worth of work and not lose their job, you know. But I get to do that.
Lee Child was saying the way he writes is that he reads the last five pages he writes, and then he writes some more, and then he stops. And then when he picks it up again, he reads the last five pages he writes, and then he writes some more, and then he stops. And then when he's done, he turns the manuscript in.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just to show you there is another way.
Yeah.
That's just like stuff.
Yeah. I mean, again, I'm probably not the only one who's done this on this show, but Somerset Maugham and that famous quote that there are three rules for writing the novel, and unfortunately no one knows what they are.
Exactly.
you know, true words were never spoken. I mean, you really... It would be lovely to box it all up. And I do think there are some good works out there about writing that
right.
new writers can take comfort from.
Right. Yeah, like Bird by Bird is a good
excellent novel.
Book.
I'd recommend any of Larry Block's
yep.
Books on writing. Mm-hmm. There's a book called The Art and Craft of Writing Novel by Oakley Hall. It may be hard to find now because I think it's unfortunately out of print. But if it isn't, or if, even if you have to, you know, hunt it down for a used book,
right.
it's a good one. I don't agree with everything he says about writing, but I do think that some of the passages he has in there, for example, if you're having trouble grasping what show don't tell means,
mm-hmm.
he explains it beautifully.
Oh, great. Okay, so, speaking about characters evolving, I was curious about when I saw this, it's like it's obvious how your protagonists are evolving. Do you think your villains are evolving, too?
Oh, they definitely have. I have much more sympathy for the devil these days in some ways. I mean, Nick Parrish, I didn't have much fondness for.
Right.
He was very tough to spend time with.
But that gang, you really liked that. I mean, you really portrayed that gang really
In Nine?
Yeah.
You know, interestingly with Nine, this is one of the reasons I enjoy not outlining is I had planned that Freddie would just be this, he'd have a little walk-on role. He'd follow somebody to New Mexico, report where she was, and that would be that.
Mm-hmm.
And lo and behold, you know, he becomes this sort of linchpin for the resolution of the novel. and took up many more pages. Because as I got to know him, he both amused me and fascinated me in a way that made me just feel, I ended up really actually feeling sorry for him.
Mm.
Because I began to see how he had been caught up in
events.
Yeah. You know, and he had a weakness that the weakness any villain must have in these stories, you know, somewhere in that.
Yeah, but I think that's kind of like where your heroes evolve, too. It's more like deficiencies of character than it is evilness.
Uh-huh.
Or craziness.
Yeah, I've never liked, I mean, I think even with Nicholas Parrish, his insanity makes perfect sense to him.
Right. Right.
And I've never liked the kind of mystery where you go through all this and the answer is why he was just nuts. You know,
I mean, that
doesn't fly.
I know. I was a psychotherapist for 20 years. I agree.
You know, it just isn't. I don't like rabbits out of hats either. I don't like this thing of. Somebody who delivered the mail turns out to be the killer. We didn't see him do anything more than drop a postcard through a slot, but, you know,
The trick in that, because it's like I've always been accused of flagging my villains too early, because if you give them time and attention, then an astute reader will go, oh, that must be the villain.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, it's very subtle to try, I mean, in the novel that's going to come out in February, I think I have, like, done a better job of disguising who actually was the killer.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really hard to, like, give that person space and depth and character at the same time without, like, making it obvious that I'm so interested in her, this must be the person that did it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, of course now it's been, there's always the question whether you're writing a straight mystery, you know, you need to do that. I mean,
right, the whodunit mystery.
Right.
That's
but
I think about crime fiction, you have a little bit more room if you go into a more thriller genre.
Right. I think the other thing that happens is that you begin to admire people who are masters of misdirection,
mm-hmm.
People who can, who are ready not just for the average reader, who can be fairly easily fooled with a basic parlor trick,
right,
but be ready for the professional
reader
in the audience. I mean,
right.
I was talking about this actually in a recent Sunday, that there are some people who really are almost professional mystery readers.
Uh-huh.
And it's a closed world in a book.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like a kind of Xbox game or something where you can, you know, suddenly create a character at will or something,
right.
You know, like you can in some computer
game.
Right, it's
a small little set of players on the stage.
Right, right. And it's going to all fit between those covers. So it's, at some point, yes, you know, just by statistics, you know, somebody can pick out the killer. And I sometimes find when I hear someone tell me that they think I had too many characters, I know exactly what kind of reader that is. That's a person who's been hoping all along they could spot, you know, this person or that person, and I've thrown too many people at them.
right.
But I'm, you know, that's not what I'm writing anyway, you know, but it's a while for some people to get that.
Okay, there's one question I want to ask, which is, tell me about Christina Mirabilis, St. Christina the Astounding. What is
Christina the Astonishing?
The Astonishing.
Yes. Well, it's not. Yes. She's astonishing.
No kidding. I read about her. It's like, holy shit. Levitating up in the corner with epilepsy.
Yeah, believe you pulled that up out of somewhere. Oh, God. Well, you know, I came across her. I don't even remember what research I was doing now, but what I was looking into. In the annals of hagiography, she stood out as just being one of the more bizarre. I have to say, having grown up Catholic, the church is truly full of
very
oddball saints who
have
done really bizarre things credited to them. And, you know, Odo of Cluny talks to a wolf, you know, talking to animals, you know, miraculous recoveries, all these kinds of things are fairly standard. But then you have the ones that just do something that make you feel that someone who had a particular form of schizophrenia got a hold of some paper and wrote about them.
I know, but she, lived to be 75 years old.
Yes, but flew up into the rafters during a church service. To me, I just thought, you know, if someone just handed you a piece of paper right now and said, this is what I witnessed, you'd tell them that we now have medication.
Right,
this.
It's true. Yeah,
so,
they went in the 1100s.
Yeah. So it's sad in a way. It's sad in a way. But, I'm trying to remember now who I read a book by once where the poor male character in the story was married to someone who was having religious visions, and the author did a great job of I can't remember the name of this book but I just remember when I came across these passages thinking what an incredible job she had done of portraying how miserable it would be to be married to a saint. By our standards, would have been insane.
I know, totally.
Yeah.
Of course, Jesus probably would have been insane.
This is true. I mean, you know, who knows? I mean, everything in its time.
Right.
And that's the answer to that question in the, Jesus Christ Superstar.
Right.
That's why he chose that time.
Okay, thank you so much. I appreciate you coming here.
Thank you.
It was tons of fun talking with you.
Well, I appreciate all the work you obviously put into it, David.
Oh, I enjoy it. It's like my chance to play detective.
Yeah, well, I have to admit, St. Christina was a surprise.
Good. I'm glad I got one.
I have to tell Sharon Newman that we got another mention in.
All right. Okay, thank you all, and thanks for all for listening in, and we'll be here on the first Thursday of December for our next Murder Thursday.
Thanks, David.
Okay, so long.
Bye.